Good evening and welcome to the third presentation in this, our ninth series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Service, I coordinate this series with my colleague outside, Peggy Wright, with assistance from Haiwang Wan, our website and virtual library coordinator, and Brian Carson, our reference coordinator. Our technical specialist tonight is Jason Hatman. Special thanks tonight to the Kentucky Space Grant Consortium and Professor Hackney for helping us publicize this event. Our speaker tonight is a native of Galesburg, Illinois, who grew up in Greenville, South Carolina, attended college in Lamoni, Iowa, and we first met as graduate students together at Louisiana State University. Our speaker tonight earned his MA and PhD in history. Since graduating, he's held a variety of government, military, and teaching positions and served as chief historian of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration for more than a decade, before some 6 years ago becoming curator of the National Air and Space Museum at the Smithsonian. His research interests are broad and diverse. He's the author and editor of more than 25 books on aerospace history. These include Space Stations, Space Camps to the Stars, published by the Smithsonian in 2003, To Reach a High Frontier, A History of U.S. Launch Vehicles, published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2002, and Imagining Space Achievements, Possibilities and Projections, 1950 to 2050, published by Chronicle Books in 2001. And many others, including a bilingual series I noticed recently in Spanish and English for children on the sun, stars, and planets. His other historical interests include Mormon history and the history of big league baseball, with a special interest in the history of the St. Louis Cardinals. His writings have garnered a host of awards for history and biography, including the Best Book Award from the John Whitmer Historical Association in 1988 for Invisible Saints, the Evans Award for Biography in 1988 for Joseph Smith III, Pragmatic Prophet, the Madison Prize in 1994 for an article, NASA and the Decision to Build the Space Shuttle, and the Matthews Prize in 1995 for his article, A New Way of War, The Development of Military Aviation in the American West. His newest book, Robots in Space, Technology, Evolution, and Interplanetary Travel, which he co-wrote with Howard McCurdy, was published earlier this year by Johns Hopkins University Press. It's the focus of tonight's talk. Since there's no place further away than space, it's our very great pleasure to welcome Roger Lanius.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. I'm going to take you on a breathless survey of a very unique area. And it is a faraway place. I'm not sure it has strange-sounding names. Mars is fairly well-known. It's a pretty easy name to understand. That's the book. I never get tired of plugging it. So if you have a desire, feel free to read it. Check it out at the library. Better yet, buy it. And I think you'll enjoy it. I am at the National Air and Space Museum. How many of you have ever been there? Most of you. Okay, cool. We never tire of telling this. It is the most visited museum in the world. It gets more than 8 million visitors a year. It's a pretty good gig. I can't complain about working there. I come in early in the morning and I walk past the Apollo 11 command module and I genuflect before it. Then I go over to the John Glenn's Friendship 7 capsule from 1962 and I bow before it. And then I go to my office and have a pretty good day. What I want to really talk about tonight is this whole business of robots in space. When you think about it, most of the people who thought about spaceflight from a very early period of the 20th century, literally up to the present, think about it in the context of humans doing things. Never mind the fact that robots have done the vast majority of any exploration that has taken place in space, literally from the beginning of the space age, and clearly they're doing all of it now. Astronauts flying 200 miles overhead in an International Space Station might be cool, but they're not exploring anything. It's the robots that are going to Mars, the robots that went to Titan, the robots that are out heading to the outer planets, even today, they're on their way to Pluto. Those are the true explorers. But most people didn't recognize it as such early on. We all thought it was going to be about humans going somewhere. This is the picture of the cover of a magazine from 1945 called Wireless World. And in this article, Arthur C. Clarke, everybody's heard of Arthur C. Clarke, have you not? Famous science fiction writer, space futurist, just died earlier this year. Sir Arthur passed away in his home in Sri Lanka. And in October of 1945, he wrote an article that said, you know, if you take a satellite and you put it at geostationary orbit, and geostationary orbit is high enough that it rotates at the same speed that the Earth rotates. It's about 22,000 miles and change. And if you put three of those around the Earth, you could use them to bounce radio signals and television signals and any other kind of signal that you want between them and up and down to ground stations. And with three satellites, we can have instantaneous global telecommunications. That's what he said in 1945. He was absolutely right. So geosynchronous telecommunications satellites, which, by the way, are the norm today. There are literally hundreds of them in Earth orbit, and they're ubiquitous. We don't think about them, but I will guarantee you that sometime today you tapped into a satellite that is in geosynchronous orbit. If you went to an ATM, if you opened up the TV and watched the Weather Channel, you looked on the internet, you did any number of those other things, you were using a satellite like he envisioned in 1945. But what he envisioned as telecommunication satellites are not what we have today. He said, you know, we're going to have to put people on that satellite at geosynchronous orbit because they're going to have to do, among other things, changing the vacuum tubes that you would need to operate the system. Those of you who are a little younger don't know what a vacuum tube is, but those of you who are a little older know that you used to have to wait for them to warm up before you would get the television signal or any of that other stuff. But that was what he thought was going to be the case. I had visions with telecommunication satellites like he had, some telephone operator plugging and unplugging switches between various systems. Again, those of you who are a little older will remember that kind of stuff. Those of you who are too young won't know anything about it. But nonetheless, that's what he envisioned. Even his idea of a satellite had to have people on board. One of the most forward-thinking and insightful futurists in the 20th century did not envision the electronics and telecommunications revolution that would change our lives. He envisioned certain parts of it, but not all of it. Instead, what he envisioned is the same sort of thing that you saw a little bit later on. This is an image from Collier's Magazine in 1952. Again, some of you who are a little older may remember this, and some of you who are a little older may remember Collier's Magazine. It was one of those great weekly magazines like the Saturday Evening Post and Life and Look and all those that are gone now, and it's gone too, that published all kinds of stories, nonfiction, fiction, all kinds of stuff, and everybody read this thing. It was in the barbershops, it was in the beauty salons, and my parents got it when I was a kid. In 1952, Collier's Magazine began to publish a series of articles about the future of spaceflight. And the argument was, and this is before anything had ever happened, there was no spaceflight at this point in time. And what the argument was is that within a very short period of time, within just a very few years, we're going to send people to explore the moon and Mars. And this was the kind of thing that it was look like. This is a painting by an artist named Chesley Bonestell. Can everybody see this in the back? Okay, good. And it's a very elaborate sort of painting. What you see is floating over the Yucatan Peninsula, a wheeled space station, and a winged reusable vehicle, a space shuttle, if you will. And there's astronauts who are doing things, and they're unloading cargo, and they're wandering around and doing all this kind of stuff. That's what spaceflight was all about. And this is the model that most people had in the 1950s, and literally they expressed this pretty clearly up through the 1970s. Some still talk about it. I can't tell you how many times that when I worked for NASA, we would go up to Capitol Hill and talk to members of Congress who would ask us the question, how come that space station, which by the way is 10 years old today, the International Space Station in Earth orbit, doesn't look like the one that's in that movie. If you saw 2001 A Space Odyssey, a number of years ago, those of you who are younger might not remember it. Those of you who are a little older, you better remember it. And this is exactly the model that was based upon. And we had to explain why they were different. It had a powerful imagery about it. But that's what Earth orbit was going to be like. The second thing was we were going to mount these massive expeditions. And here you can see another wheeled space station in the background, space shuttles here, and the building in orbit of an armada to go to Mars. And that's how we were going to accomplish space exploration. From there, they would go to Mars. They would land on the Mars surface in vehicles that looked surprisingly like V-2 rockets from World War II. And they would ultimately build a domed place to stay there. And this was going to be thousands of people involved in this process. That is the expectations of spaceflight in the 1950s. That's not what we did. We've done some things that are quite interesting and useful, but this is not what we did. Instead, we did a whole variety of other things. But it is in part because of the rise of our robotic spaceflight that we were able to take the approach that we have taken in space exploration rather than these huge, big armadas of space vehicles. And since the very beginning of NASA, 50 years ago now, there has been this debate over piloted, in other words, astronauts, versus robotic spaceflight missions. It's been a pretty significant debate, and people come down on both sides. All right, let me ask a question. How many of you, if given the opportunity, would like to fly in space? Raise your hands. How many would you not want to do it no matter what, no how, no where? How about if an asteroid was going to hit Earth and everybody here was going to die? Okay. Regardless of how you look at all of this, you have to pull back and ask yourself the question, what are we trying to accomplish in space? If the answer to that question is, we want to learn about the solar system, we want to learn about the universe, we want to amass knowledge, we understand the science of all of this, then robots have been doing that pretty well. And they are less expensive, and oh, by the way, we don't care whether they come back or not. Nobody told Spirit and Opportunity on Mars that they were on a suicide mission. But they are. They're not coming home. And we didn't get informed consent from them. But on the other hand, those robots are robots. They're not all that smart. They can do certain things, but they can't do other things. And so you find that the robots have this advantage of they're pretty robust, they're pretty hardy, they survive pretty well in space. We don't survive at all in space. As a species, we are very well adapted for life on the surface of this planet and not really anywhere else. We can't go underground, we can't go under the ocean, we can't go very high into the atmosphere, and we certainly can't go into space. We are surface sea level dwellers, and robots don't have that problem. At the same time, humans have this enormous creativity that we bring to anything that we want to do. We can solve problems, we can make decisions, we can change things on the fly and make them work. Robots aren't very good at that, at least not yet. So that's been the fundamental debate. If you want to send robot emissaries to study places and send back data to you, we do that very well with scientific probes and robots and Spirit and Opportunity on Mars and all of the other things that have taken place along those lines. If you want to move outward and ultimately become a multi-planetary species, we absolutely positively have to go ourselves. That's kind of the gist of what the debate is about that Howard McCurdy and I wrestle with in this book. Now, by the way, when you think about robots, we usually think of them in two ways. The first way is, and this comes right out of science fiction literature. The first is, as human helpers. And everybody's familiar with R2-D2 and C-3PO from Star Wars, right? Okay. And some of you are a little older will remember Robbie the Robot from Forbidden Planet in the 1950s. They're helpers. They do things for us. They are essentially a 21st century version of a servant. And we don't really much care about them beyond that. So they have a positive but ancillary and subordinate role to the humans that they are helping. In some cases, they're obnoxious. And in both Forbidden Planet and Star Wars, that robot, the gold one anyway, was really obnoxious. I kept wanting him to get blown up, and he never did. Anyway, so that's one model for how robots have been envisioned in terms of space exploration or anything else. The second model, which is one that's a little more scary, is as human threats. And in science fiction, again, we have that particular mindset that's also present. And the picture that you can see in the upper left is from 2001 A Space Odyssey, where HAL, the computer that ran the spacecraft, went berserk and killed the crew. He's evil. Actually, he's not. The programming got screwed up. But nonetheless, kill people. And then, of course, down on the bottom, you can see the Terminator from the Terminator series. That's still a movie that everybody knows about, right? Yeah. Okay. But choose the movie of your choice. 2001 A Space Odyssey, the Terminator series, Blade Runner, the Matrix trilogy, on and on and on. And you find that machines, robots, are the enemy. They are evil, and they must be defeated. And we can't rely upon them. Those are the two models. There's very little in between. Let me suggest that there's another way to look at this. And, of course, NASA loves to talk about this. There's this old saying, I heard it 100 times at NASA, we don't give ticker tape parades for robots. Actually, we don't. We don't give ticker tape parades for astronauts anymore either, although they used to in the 1960s. But they have undertaken the majority of the exploration missions, and some of them have given their lives, so to speak, in the cause of space exploration. Voyager 1 and 2 to the outer planets in the 1970s and 80s, the Mars exploration, a whole succession of missions there, and these debates have continued to rage right up to the present. Official position that NASA has about humans and robots is one that we have to do it together. That robots provide a certain level of capability that we don't have without them, and they, of course, don't have the decision-making skills to do the things that need to be done in space. And so there's a succession of quotes here about how we might do that. And I won't quote those for you, but they're partners, essentially, in this whole process of space exploration. But I love this particular quote. Anybody heard of James Van Allen before? Yeah, okay. Everybody genuflect when you say that name. James Van Allen, whose name is now used to describe the radiation belts around Earth, the Van Allen radiation belts. He's a space scientist. It goes back to the early 1950s, and in 1958, it was his experiment on Explorer 1 that discovered those radiation belts. And I would suggest to you that that was a pretty significant discovery. Anyway, Van Allen hated human spaceflight. He thought it was a disaster. He thought it was stupid. We shouldn't do it. We're spending all this money on it, and it doesn't serve any purpose. And he's a scientist. My position is that it's high time for a calm debate on more fundamental questions. Does human spaceflight continue to serve a compelling cultural purpose and/or our national interest? Risk is high. Cost is enormous. Science is insignificant. Does anyone have a good rationale for sending humans into space? Those are important questions. And Jim, until the day he died in 2006, kind of held to that particular belief throughout his career that human spaceflight was worthless. And oh, by the way, let's just kill that program and send the astronauts home and give all that money to space science and I can put it to good work. And so there's a certain self-servingness to this, as you might guess. It doesn't work like that, of course. Anybody who's with Congress or Washington knows that the bureaucracy is such that you delete one program, it doesn't mean that something that's logical and related to it is going to get that funding. It's probably going to go somewhere to build a pork project for some particular congressman in some particular district. So that is a fundamental question, and you have to ask it. Why are we doing human spaceflight? What is our purpose? And the bottom line in my mind, and the only justification that really stands up to any scrutiny whatsoever, is that we want to become a multiplanetary species. We have to get off this planet. We have to put colonies on the moon or Mars or wherever the place is that you want to go. And the reality is if we don't do that, we will become extinct here. That is 100% guaranteed certainty. The best case scenario is that about 4 to 5 billion years in the future, the sun will become a red giant and will engulf the Earth and everybody here will die. We have to be somewhere else as a species before that happens. But I will tell you from experience, it is impossible to get a member of Congress concerned about something that's going to happen 4 to 5 billion years in the future. They don't even think beyond the next election. So that doesn't sell very well, but that's ultimately the reason. There are, of course, more fundamental threats that are closer to us. We could nuke ourselves. Of course, maybe we only have ourselves to blame if we do that, and I'm not sure we shouldn't be extinct if we're stupid enough to do that. We could so foul the planet that we can't live here any longer. We can't survive. Again, maybe we get what we deserve if that's the case. And then there's, of course, asteroid impacts that could destroy all life on this planet. It's happened at least once before that we know of. Most scientists now believe that about 76 million years ago, the dinosaurs were wiped out by climate change that resulted from an asteroid impact. And with that as the case, Arthur C. Clarke, the fellow I mentioned to you earlier, actually made a very witty comment about that. He says, you know, if the dinosaurs had had a space program, they wouldn't be extinct today. He may be right about that. But if it's not about getting off this planet, if it's not about becoming a multiplanetary species, then you really do have to ask yourself the question, why send people in the first place? I believe, actually, it is about becoming a multiplanetary species. I think that's what we have to do. It may take us a long time to get there, and it's a very difficult task. but that's what it's all about. This is another little slide that basically says that humans and robot capabilities are not comparable at this point in time. You can't send a robot to do a human's job. You can't send a human to do a robot's job. Pretty much a true statement. And this is a Space Studies Board report from the National Academy of Sciences in 2005 that says essentially that. Ah, you'll love this. Looks like a lot of squiggliness. Okay, what you see is the traverse maps laid across against each other, Apollo astronauts on the moon and lunar rovers on the moon, Lunokhod 1 and Lunokhod 2 that the Soviets sent there, and Spirit and Opportunity. And all it suggests is that humans, in a very short period of time, can cover a lot more territory, make decisions, collect data, and come back and come home. It took Spirit and Opportunity 4 years to go this far, about 4 kilometers. It took Apollo 17 about 3 days to do 17 kilometers. That's a pretty big difference. And that's really what it says. Robots are not as capable, but they obviously can go for longer periods. But all of our human exploration scenarios essentially end with landing on the planet Mars. This is a Collier's magazine cover from the 1950s, which says, can we get to Mars? Is there life on Mars? And by the way, they thought there was. And it talks about that armada, and that's where we're going to end up going. Not that we're going to necessarily live there. It doesn't talk about that. It talks about going there on an expedition. And this is a very recent NASA picture. They love pretty pictures. And I should know, I was there for 12 years. And I would also tell you it's a whole lot easier to draw this stuff than it is to build it and fly it. Anyway, and here's an astronaut on Mars leaning down to pick up the little rover that landed there in 1997, Sojourner, and bring it back to Earth. All of our scenarios for human spaceflight essentially end with Mars. Why is that? We can't really envision much beyond that. And the reason is because we thought we might find something useful and we could survive on Mars, but nowhere else in the solar system. Then there's, of course, interstellar travel. Can we go to some other star system where there might be an Earth-like planet where we could get off the spaceship and live and work there? That's certainly conceivable, but it's going to be hard to do. There's really only 4 methods of accomplishing interstellar flight. The first one is some sort of faster-than-light speed. Everybody's seen Star Trek, Star Wars, all these movies. They deal with it in that particular way, and they solve the problem of the great distances in space by some faster-than-light capability. Well, there's a whole lot of virtually every physicist who will tell you this is not possible. There's some who say it will be, but who knows? Right now, and Einstein said it wasn't possible. And thus far, that's all we know. So faster-than-light speed, if that's a concept that we can accomplish, then maybe we can do this and send people to another star system where they can settle an Earth-like planet once we find one. The second method of doing it is a multi-generational spaceship. And one that's big enough, as big as a city, that you put whole families in this thing and they live and die, and multiple generations know nothing but the inside of the spaceship until they reach their destination and they get off and they go about doing the things that they were going to do and settle somewhere else. When I was a boy in Boy Scouts, when I was about 11 years old, before I got kicked out, I was asked to leave the Boy Scout camp. There were things that kept exploding. There was a magazine that the Boy Scouts had called Boy's Life, and some of you who are Boy Scouts may know about this. And it had a series of articles with the hero of was a boy who was actually a Boy Scout about my age, and he was on a multi-generational spaceship, and they were going someplace else. And it was a whole series of stories, and I used to eat this stuff up. I read it every month when it came out, yada, yada, yada. And then the last of the stories appeared, and they arrived at the new location. And it had been many, many generations. He had never seen anything inside of the spaceship. His parents had never seen anything beyond that. His grandparents had never seen anything beyond that. For generations, nobody on the spaceship knew anything beyond the walls of the spaceship. Anyway, they arrive at the new location, and nobody can figure out why they came. What's the point of getting off? And it creates a huge, interesting, and dynamic in all of this. But that's a second method, a multi-generational spaceship that would take us to another star system. The third way is suspended animation. You've, again, seen this in movies. Can you slow down the bodily functions long enough that it can survive for many, many years with almost no change or perhaps no change whatsoever of the bodily capabilities and no aging and all that business? and then somehow reawaken on the other side and go do whatever it is you were going to do. That's the fourth method. The last method was be an extremely long-lived species. We're basically a species that can live for something less than 100 years. And some folks make it a little over that. Most people don't make it quite that far. But that's a good round number, and we can stick with that. Can we extend that for 1,000 years, for 2,000 years, for 5,000 years? If you can live that long, you can make that journey. Otherwise, you can't. Well, all of these are science fiction at this point in time, and they probably will remain science fiction. But the extremely long-lived species led me down the path of asking the question, what about those sorts of things? Can we modify the human body in ways that will make it able to survive and thrive in space in ways that we can't do today? And that may be the future of spaceflight for humans. Let me suggest that there are four phases of space exploration. We've gone through three of them, and we may be heading into a fourth. First, there's this human venture in which we send people off to go do certain things. We've been doing that now since 1961. We continue to do it. Ultimately, we will probably send people back to the moon. We may even send people to Mars at some point in time. So that's the first phase. The second phase, which coincides with the first, is robotic technology, which gets good enough to send us back information about those places, and we can go virtually, but not physically. And we're doing that today. How many of you have gone out on the net and looked at all the pictures of Spirit and Opportunity? I'm sure some of you have. Or the Phoenix Lander on Mars, or New Horizons, or Messenger, or you name the spaceship of your choice, and it's sending back all kinds of imagery and doing all kinds of cool stuff. So that's the second phase. There's a third phase, which we're also engaged in, which is kind of remote sensing. And we have got scientists at ground-based observatories as well as with space-based assets who are looking to identify elements that are out beyond this solar system and finding planets around other stars. That was unheard of a generation ago. We thought that they were there, but we didn't know that. Now we do. We have actually imaged some of those planets. Now, they're all pretty big, and they're about the size of Jupiter, and they're probably not someplace we'd want to visit, but nonetheless, they are there. And we're doing that through the electromagnetic remote sensing capabilities that we have been involved in for a number of years. And then finally, there may be a phase that comes forward in the future where there is a merger, a beginning of a merger between humans and machines so that humans can become more hardy in space flight. How many of you are cyborgs? I'm a cyborg. I see several in the audience. How many of you have been enhanced some way with technology? I see lots of glasses. I'll bet you there's pacemakers. There's probably artificial hips, artificial knees. I have two stents in my heart. I have cataract surgery. I'm a diabetic. I take pills. Without those things, without that technological and scientific intervention, I would, at the very least, not be in very good shape, and I might be dead. I'm already a cyborg. How far do we want to go down this path? Can we make decisions that will enhance our capabilities to survive in space through the merger of humans and machines? Now, this may sound like science fiction, and it is. But I would remind you that in the 1920s and 30s and 40s and early 50s, people were talking about spaceflight in the same way. It was science fiction. Nobody had ever done it. How far are we from those sorts of things perhaps taking place? We're already doing it in a modest way now. What about modifying humans so they can survive in space more effectively? People have been talking about this. People have been doing research on it. In 1960, two NASA-funded scientists, a fellow by the name of Manfred Kleins and Nathan Klein, without an S, published an article in Astronautics talking about, where they coined the term cyborgs, talking about the possibility of merging machines and humans to allow humans to survive more effectively in space. And they asked the question this way, which is easier to do? Create a bubble so that we can survive in the vacuum in the very rigorous and rigid place of space where we can't survive today, or modify humans so that they can do it. And their answer to that question was, we probably can modify humans and make it easier to survive in space. NASA followed this up in 1963 with what was known as the Cyborg Study, asking that very question. What are the technologies, what are the medical interventions that might allow us to harden an astronaut so they can survive in space? How many of you think that's possible? Okay, a couple of people. Actually, it is possible. And although our species is very poorly suited to spaceflight, There are other living organisms that can survive space. And I will give you one example. In 1966, Surveyor 3, which was a soft lander, landed on the moon. And in 1969, in November of 1969, the Apollo 12 crew, their task was to land as close to that spacecraft as possible on the moon, go over to it, take pieces of it off, and bring it home. And they did. And when they brought it home, they started looking at it, and they found that there was bacteria. It was Streptococcus bacteria that had been on the spacecraft when it was launched. It had gone into hibernation while it was on the moon, and when it came back to Earth, it revived and started doing all the stuff Strep does. So there's bacteria that is Earth-born and Earth-bound that can survive in space. What about more complex organisms? We don't know, but it's conceivable that we can figure out ways to enhance that capability as well. Anyway, there's lots of thoughts about this. But if this is a possibility, might we suggest that this could be the next stage of human evolution? Even absent this, I was telling some folks earlier today, even absent this, when you start thinking about colonies on the moon or Mars, what happens when you move into the colony stage? Let's just do a little thought experiment. You know, we can send sortees to the moon. We've done that. The Apollo astronauts went and spent time there. By the way, everybody does believe we landed on the moon, right? Good. We absolutely positively did. We sent astronauts there. They were basically on little camping trips. They were out there for 3-4 days, and then they came back. We can probably put some sort of a research station on the moon and cycle people in and out, bring them in and out on a 3-month, 6-month basis, resupply it from Earth, do all that kind of stuff. It would probably look a lot like Antarctica. The way in which you have scientists down there doing all kinds of things, and they bring them in and out. And if you want to go down there, you've got to pass all kinds of physicals, and you're going to be prepared to stay there for several months. But nonetheless, it is possible. But nobody lives there on a permanent basis. Somewhere between that research station and a colony, that means people are going to live there. They're going to bring their families. Those families are going to be born. They're going to live. They're going to die. So let's ask the question, what happens to the first human fetus that is gestated in 1/6 gravity on the moon? Assuming it even survives, how will that child be different from children born here on Earth? I can tell you it will be different. 1/6 gravity means that it's going to be remarkably different, and it's certainly not going to be acclimated to Earth-like gravity. Maybe there's radiation, maybe there's other things that are going to affect it. It will be different. It will be different in the same way that the first creatures crawling out of the sea evolved so that they could survive as amphibians on the land and ultimately became, some of them, land creatures. It is absolutely no way around it, human evolution. Accepted as a natural trait like this, we can perhaps work toward it ourselves through a merger of humans and machines, and I would suggest that that's probably what might happen in the next couple of 300 years. Not going to happen probably in my lifetime in any serious way, maybe not in yours. But somewhere down the road, I think that there will be changes along those lines. So let me just close with this. Do we have Robo sapiens that might be the next stage of human evolution? Spaceflight is limited to the inner solar system for humans, at best, in all current situations. We can envision going to the moon, we can envision going to Mars, we can envision going to a few asteroids, and that's just about it. We can envision going beyond the solar system, but that's so hard to do, it's essentially not going to happen anytime soon. Robotic spaceflight has the capability to explore all of the solar system and maybe beyond, but for humans to go, we've got to change the paradigm. We've got to change the approach, and this may be the way in which we go. The last couple of chapters of the book really kind of look at this whole issue of possible futures. And it does get kind of funky. There's no question about that. It's strange and weird. It's totally science fiction, but maybe it's science fiction that's based on some fact. There is some research that's been done on this. It is, I think, a possibility down the road. So are we looking at the evolution of a new species? Are we looking at Homo sapien astronautica, or choose to call it whatever you wish? I think that's quite possible. And only the future is going to tell. Anyway, that's what I wanted to talk about tonight. That's what the book is about. Most of it is about the push and pull of the various debates over what we should do in space, human versus robots. Much of it walks through popular culture and talks about film and literature. and how we've played out some of these things in a science fiction realm. And then the last, as I say, couple of chapters talk about the idea of transhumanism and the movement of humans into a new species, enhanced technologically. We're already going there. We're already there at some level. How much that's going to continue into the future is an open question, but I would guarantee you that there will be new technological enhancements that people will come up with. There are radicals who say that the fact that I've got a cell phone in my pocket makes me a cyborg. There's others who would say that that iPods and all this other stuff. I mean, everybody's wired all the time now. It's not necessarily the same as having something inserted into your body, but it's certainly pretty much a part of you. In fact, I feel naked without all that stuff that I have that carts around that's electronic, and I suspect some of you do the same. How far are we away from being able to jack into the internet through some sort of plug in your head? It's not beyond the pale. I know people who have some of those plugs for purposes of medical disabilities. What about other possibilities down the road? Anyway, with that, let me close, and I'll be glad to take any slings, arrows, arguments, whatever you've got to give. At this point, I'll be glad to try to deal with them. So thank you very much. Questions? Yeah.
I wonder if across your research you run into this, I recall a project called Biosphere.
Sure.
Where people tried to stay isolated for a little while.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot.
Oh, really? Was it successful? What do you recall?
It wasn't. Is that, who all has heard of Biosphere 2? Many of you. In the late 80s and early 90s, a billionaire philanthropist built this facility just outside of Tucson called Biosphere 2. Biosphere 1, by the way, is the Earth. And Biosphere 2 was basically an experiment. Can we create a closed loop so that people can go in and live in this place for more than a year without any outside activity, without anything brought in from the outside? Recycling air, having water that worked, that recycled, raising your own crops, all that kind of stuff. Can you survive in this thing? It was an interesting experiment. It didn't work very well. One of the things that happened was that psychological problems were more difficult than the physical ones, because they turned into kind of warring factions and fought with each other and stuff like that, closed off from the world as they were. And then if you saw that really bad movie with Pauly Shore, actually, Pauly Shore and bad movies kind of go together, where he and his buddy spend time in the biosphere, kind of gives you a sense of how weird it was. But anyway, they eventually had to open the doors, and it failed short of them completing the tasks. But it was an interesting experiment, and by the way, it's a tourist site now. If you want to go to Tucson and go see it, you're more than welcome to pay your $15 and do that. Anybody else?
Can you tell us a bit about collecting all of this space material that you do at the Smithsonian, what's involved in it?
All right, well, I'm the senior curator for space history at the museum, and we have a small staff of curators who are charged with a couple of different things. The first is collecting artifacts from the space age. And we collect all kinds of stuff. I mean, we obviously collect big hardware. So we have Enterprise, the space shuttle orbiter that was used for test purposes in the 1970s. But we also have things like, comic books, lunch buckets, popular culture sorts of things, little medallions, stuff like that, that people have struck for whatever purpose. And sometimes those end up in our collection as well. So that's the first task, is collecting this stuff. The second task is preserving this stuff. Can we make sure that it does not deteriorate in a way that future generations will not be able to see it? We've got enormous challenges here. Before I came to the Smithsonian, I didn't necessarily think about this too much, but it's become very clear to me that we're dealing with things not just for the foreseeable future, but for the indefinite future. And that 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now, our descendants should be able to visit the Smithsonian or whatever it calls itself in those days, and see the spacecraft that flew to the moon, and see the space suits that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin wore on the moon. And those are important challenges. How do we do that? So that's a very serious task. The third task, fundamental task, is to tell the story of all of this using these artifacts and exhibitry. It's a challenge that sometimes seems almost insurmountable. How do you do justice to a very complex story in a very short period of time, a limited amount of space, and a small amount of artifacts? Where you've got people who, have any of you been with somebody who breezes through an exhibit in about 2 minutes? And how many of you are people who breeze through an exhibit in 2 minutes and your spouse is, wants to read every word? That happens too. It's very frustrating on both sides, let me tell you. So trying to communicate to both the person who breezes through in 2 minutes and gets the main story and the person who reads every word of all of the labels and ponders them and looks at them and does all that sort of thing, how you cater to those various groups is really hard to do. I've become very worshipful of those who can do it successfully. It is hard. And so that's the other part of what we try to do. And in that context, things like this book is a part of the background information that we use to bring to the intellectual content to those exhibits. So, in a nutshell.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
And it may sound strange or stupid or whatever, but is there current experimentation on humans that give you the view that humans will change? Is there a little bit of evidence that moves you gradually toward the future?
Sure.
What is that?
Well, I think there's lots of evidence for it. One of the things that we're finding is that that people are changing their... we're seeing this in the natural patterns. We're seeing generations are growing taller. They're growing stronger in some cases. In some cases, they're growing smaller. They're getting smaller. And so there's things like, it's not that people have six toes or anything like that.
But I mean, like when they are in space, is there something you are looking for in a human, those persons who are there, to say, okay, this race is strong enough to adapt to the, and what is some of that?
Yeah, well, there is biomedical work that's being done on the astronauts. There's some real issues with that. One is the population is very, very small. And when you've got a small population, you may get results that are not indicative of what you would have if you had a larger sample. The second thing is that the astronauts try desperately to control their biomedical data. And this shouldn't surprise anybody. There's an old saying at NASA, the last astronaut will not be happy until they have strangled the last flight surgeon with the entrails of the next to the last flight surgeon. Flight surgeons are there to tell you you can't fly, that there's something wrong with you. No astronaut wants to be told they can't fly. So they base that on the biological data that they have about that person. The astronauts don't want to give that up very easily, and they don't most of the time very easily. So there's some problems with it. I don't know how to solve that problem until we break the strength of the astronaut office, which I'm all for, by the way. But nonetheless, that is one of the issues. But be that as it may, we do have flight surgeons and life science people who are looking at what happens to biological entities, and not just astronauts, when they're in a weightless condition. And we're finding that there's a lot of changes that take place to the human body in Earth orbit, with as little amount of time as a shuttle flight is, only a couple of weeks. You find that there's several important things that happen. The first thing that starts to happen is that bone mass starts to deteriorate. And it's kind of a form of osteoporosis. And there are no good countermeasures for that yet. You can obviously take calcium and do certain things and mitigate it to some extent, but there's not a good countermeasure yet. The second thing that happens is your cardiovascular system also starts to wither. When you're used to working against 1G of gravity here on Earth and you no longer have that, your heart kind of takes a holiday. It doesn't have to pump as hard, it doesn't have to do as much stuff, and over a period of time, it tends to weaken. There are countermeasures for that, and that's why you see these guys riding bicycles and doing isometric exercises and all this stuff in Earth orbit to try to resolve that. The third thing, and it's not so much a problem for Earth orbit, low Earth orbit, where the shuttle is, as it is for when you go to the moon, is radiation. When you get beyond the Van Allen radiation belts especially, although there's more radiation in Earth orbit than there is on the surface here of this planet, then you take all kinds of dosages of radiation. And that can be very detrimental to the human body over a period of time. There's actually a wonderful story, and it was pure dumb luck. The Apollo 16 mission just happened to miss, by about 2 days, a major solar flare that flared up while they had just come back. And had they been on the moon at the point that flare hit, they might not have survived. We don't know. They would have taken a pretty good hit of radiation, though. And that was pure luck. Nobody could predict it. It just happened. And we're going to have to deal with that when we go back to the moon for any kind of permanent basis. Those are three of the things, and they're very real. And there's lots of other smaller pieces as well.
Do any of these things keep them from living a full life after they come back?
Well, I mean, probably not in any serious way, although I will tell you that of the Apollo astronauts that I know, the ones who have died, all had some form of cancer. Now, they were quite elderly, so, you know, there might not have been any greater incidence of it than any other part of the population. But, you know, Dee Slayton died of a brain tumor, and Alan Shepard died of cancer, and Jack Swigert, and some of the others, too. I can't think of all of them off the top of my head. But the question you have to ask is, did they get doses of radiation that were beyond what they should have had under normal circumstances had they remained on Earth? I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's an important question, and it's certainly serious. And that's often what happens. When you take doses of radiation, it's not that it ultimately that it kills you on the spot all the time. Most of the time it doesn't. It's something that accrues over a period of time. It takes its toll on you. And it's an unfortunate thing.
Back here, David.
You mentioned that this was the 10th anniversary of the International Space Station. Kind of with a decade retrospective, what do you think is the legacy of the International Space Station? What have we taken away from those 10 years?
Actually, I think the 10 years of the International Space Station has been enormously important, but not for anything that we've done on the space station, or probably will do on the space station. The fact that this is an international program, the largest multinational program ever undertaken in human history that wasn't war, it makes it remarkable. The fact that you've got 16 nations that are working together, one of them, Russia, and the other one, United States, which hated each other for 40 years, and that they're cooperating on this really big venture. I think when you look back on this in 100 years, we're going to remember the station not for the science that was done there, although it may do some, and not for the technology, although that's been pretty important as well, but for that international cooperation. And I would suggest to you that that's important. That's really important. Some of you may be, I talked about this in a book I did on space stations a few years ago. Some of you may have read Samuel Huntington's book, The Clash of Civilizations, that appeared about a little more than 10 years ago. And what he said was is that in the aftermath of the Cold War, where you had these two superpowers that had allies on either side and was kind of competing with each other on all kinds of levels, in the aftermath of that, when that competition was gone, what you saw that happened was there were civilizations that are a part of the Earth, and mostly they are ethnic, religious, or nationalistic groups that have split apart and are going their own way. They are reemerging after having been under the thumb of various, one of the two parties in the Cold War for a number of years, and the United States, of course, is a part of the West. In fact, he defines Western Europe, Canada, and the United States as the West, and then every other part of the world is a different civilization. And what he said was, this is the challenge of the 21st century. How do we deal with these different civilizations and try to maintain a semblance of peace and harmony on a planet where you've got, in some cases, ancient hate that have reemerged? And his answer to that, he had several answers, but one of them was engagement. How do you engage these various groups in peaceful activities? And I would apply that to spaceflight. From the standpoint of the International Space Station, bringing in these various other nations that might not be your ally otherwise, having them work on a peaceful activity, one that's not going to kill people and break things, at least not intentionally, and the chances are when you're doing that, you're not shooting at each other. And that's a good thing. So, you know, that cooperative venture, and I would suggest there'll be explorations of bringing China into the space station program, probably India, maybe Korea, various other places that are out there. Brazil wants in on it. All of that's a good thing. Because when you're working together on something that's big, you're not fighting with each other. I mean, you might argue because you disagree about something or another on the program, but you're not going to pick up a gun. And that's a good thing. And so I think that's really the fundamental thing that you can point to that's important about the station. And I think any future activities along these lines, if we go back to the moon with people, I guarantee you it'll be an international program, and it will have the same virtue, in my mind.
Well, with that, one more question.
Based on your time at NASA, how long do you think it will be before we have
a research station or a colony and a man on Mars.
Okay, before I answer that, let me take a poll. How many of you think we should spend tax dollars sending a man to the moon? A few people. And I'm assuming that the rest of you don't think we should, or at least are ambivalent. That's pretty much the standard. If I ask the question about Mars, how many people think we should spend tax dollars? A few. And that's pretty much the standard. That's the problem. There doesn't seem to be a clear consensus of opinion that it's something that we want to do. Now, the president announced in 2004 the vision for space exploration, and it said several things: retire the shuttle, build a new vehicle, and go to the moon by 2020. And NASA will tell you they're going to be there by 2020 with humans. Anybody want to take a bet on that?
Which way?
Yeah, okay. The question was, which way am I betting? I don't think we're going to do it in 2020. And the fundamental reason is not that we can't, or that it's too expensive, because it's not. The fundamental reason is we haven't come up with a good reason to go. And nobody's been able to articulate it. I can tell you, the reason we stopped going to the moon in 1972 was we didn't find anything there we wanted. Had we found it, we would have been going back over and over again. You know, one of the things that people like to refer to Neil Armstrong as kind of a new Christopher Columbus. Well, Christopher Columbus came here and found all kinds of things. Of course, other people owned it. But nonetheless, he found stuff that they wanted. And so they kept going back to get it. We haven't found that. And you know, a dry, rocky moon is probably not a very attractive place to do much of anything. So if we go back there, we'll do that for scientific purposes and for prestige purposes. But nobody has really articulated a clear vision of why those are important. The president-elect has said he supports the vision for space exploration, but it would be very easy for him to say, you know, we don't need this clock, and we can put off certain pieces of it, like returning to the moon, until some future time. And this is made all the more probable by the meltdown of the economy in the last few weeks, where everybody's going to be looking for tax dollars to spend on everything. So
maybe it's time to switch General Motors.
Let's quit. Yeah. Anyway, and Mars, I mean, I like to think that I would see us return to the moon in our lifetime, in my lifetime. I'd like to think that we'll see that in the next 25 years or so, but I'm not sanguine about that. Mars, I just don't see any reason to go there with people anytime soon. It's enticing, it's intriguing, it's a fun place, and we can send a lot of good robots to do cool stuff. And somebody wants to take a one-way trip, though, we could probably manage that.